Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. There are now three third-party candidates for president this year. Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party, Jill Stein of the Green Party, and announced yesterday, although he's not really affiliated with any particular party, I don't believe, Evan McMullen, who's carrying on an independent presidential bid. We know that there are high negative ratings for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Will more people be considering third-party candidates this go-around? And what will it take for third-party candidates to get invited to the presidential debates? We'll have two guests this hour, the executive director of Civil Hall, who's also author of Spoiling for a Fight, Third-Party Politics in America, later the national presidential campaign manager for Ralph Nader in 2000 and 2004, author of Grand Illusion, The Myth of Voter Choice in a Two-Party Tyranny. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Some of you may be considering third-party choices this year or have in the past. We'd love to hear what your thoughts are about that and what your considerations are. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Mika Sifri is co-founder and executive director of Civic Hall. He's co-founder of Personal Democracy Media, which produces the annual Personal Democracy Forum Conference on the ways technology is changing politics. He has taught the politics of the internet as a visiting lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School, and he's worked closely with Public Campaign, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization focused on comprehensive campaign finance reform. Mika, thanks very much for joining us. Hi.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, very good to have you with us. So with these negative ratings for both Trump and Clinton pretty high, do you think this will be a better year for third-party candidates?
Well, it is an unusual year in that both the major party candidates are so widely disliked by big chunks of the electorate. And in general, historically, when third parties tend to do best when the major parties are seen as failing. That said, I'm a little skeptical that this is going to be really a banner year for third parties, because the obstacles to them really getting mainstream attention remain quite high. And I think for a lot of people, this is such an unusual election in that Donald Trump is not a typical Republican candidate. And so I think that the temptation that some people may feel to vote third party may well be tempered by their bigger concern about what Donald Trump represents.
Mm-hmm. Susan Collins today, Senator Susan Collins, I believe, said that she said she's not voting for Trump, but she may throw her support for Gary Johnson of the Libertarian
mm-hmm.
Party.
Well, and Gary Johnson is about the best candidate that the Libertarian Party has managed to put forward in years, because, you know, people should know, we have minor parties in America, like the Libertarian Party or the Green Party, that have, in many states, candidates and in some cases elected officials at very low levels in government, state, local office, and they have to petition to get on the ballot year after year. But those two parties in particular have built up enough of a following that in many states they are regularly seen on the ballot. And the Libertarians are the best at that. With Johnson, they have a former Republican governor of the state of New Mexico who actually tried running as a Republican candidate for president and then switched to the Libertarian Party because his views matched up more closely with theirs. But he's about as mainstream a candidate that the Libertarians have put forward in my memory. And this is important because third parties often put forward very ideological candidates that satisfy the needs of their strongest followers, mm-hmm. but often they have trouble, you know, reaching beyond that hardcore following into more of a mainstream electorate.
Mm-hmm. Mika, you write about this number, and it's the only number that really matters, 15%. What is that?
Right. So, you know, we have the general election presidential debates coming up starting at the end of September. They are run by an organization that calls itself the Commission on Presidential Debates, a nice official-sounding title. In fact, It is a organization that was set up by the leaders of the Democratic and Republican parties back in the early 1980s, deliberately to take this job away from the League of Women Voters that used to be the sponsor of presidential debates. And they did this in part because they wanted to control the debates and keep them in primarily in the hands of the two major parties. People may not remember, in 1980, there was a third-party candidate named John Anderson,
sure,
who broke away from the Republican Party, and the League of Women Voters decided to invite him to the major debates, and this was a tremendous thing for opening up the spectrum of voices that people could hear, but it was a major affront and a threat to both major parties. So they created the commission. The commission has generally managed to organize debates every 4 years to its credit, but it has set up a very, very high threshold, completely arbitrary, of 15% in the national polls before they will invite any other candidates. You have to already have 15% support in an average of five national polls leading up to the debate. That's what they say. And the problem is, you know, Americans in a generic sense say they are interested in more choices. In fact, 60% regularly say they wish there was another third major political party. But getting that to focus on a specific person or a specific party is a lot harder because you need to have millions of people aware of your existence. There's nothing better than the national presidential debates for getting a tremendous amount of attention. The last time we had a third-party candidate included was Ross Perot in 1992. He was in all three major debates. He did very well, and he ultimately ended up getting close to 20% of the vote. But 4 years later, he ran again, and he was excluded from the debates because now they're being run by this commission, and his standing in the polls never reached 15%. So even if Americans had an interest in a third candidate, the commission has set the bar quite high for them to have a chance to hear from that person.
Mm-hmm. Well, as it stands right now, I know Johnson got 10% in Wisconsin during the primary. Is he or Jill Stein anywhere close to 15%?
So the rolling average right now shows him at about almost 9%, which is you know, not bad for at this stage of the game. And I think, you know, he's in shooting distance. There is a chance that he might get close or above 15% by the time of the commission making its decision on who it's inviting to the first debates at the end of September. But even if they do that, don't forget, it's not a given that these debates will happen. You know, either of the major party candidates, well, first of all, Trump has yet to officially confirm that he's coming. The Clinton campaign has done that. So there's already the possibility that there won't even be a debate. Then the second possibility is the commission maybe invites Johnson, and then one or both of the major candidates say, you know, it's not in our interest to show up for this. So there's nothing that says the debates will definitely happen. It would be a shame if they don't. I think it's vital for the electorate to be able to sort of judge the major candidates side by side. But there's no guarantee that it will happen.
Mm. When does Trump have to make his decision?
I don't know the answer to that. I think he has a couple more weeks. I mean, they're starting to raise the pressure on him. I mean, typically what happens, and you know, it's a little bit of a ugly process. You know, this is how the sausage is actually made. The major parties designate their campaign managers and top lawyers to negotiate with each other. And they typically work out an agreement, which in many of the last presidential election cycles has been a secret agreement. It's only more recently that they've begun to make these public, setting out all the terms that they agree to about how the debate will be conducted. And it literally gets to the point of what temperature the air conditioning will be set at, what height the podiums will be. They have to agree about the moderator that's going to be invited. There's a whole complex negotiation that goes on, and that's why, even though, you know, it's still almost 8 weeks away, before the first debate or 7 weeks away, the fact that Trump has not yet confirmed, we think this is just, you know, him negotiating, as he likes to brag about being such a great negotiator. But there will be a cutoff point probably soon after Labor Day where if they have not confirmed it, then the first debate may not happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Donald Trump obviously rose to prominence in large degree because of his performance in those Republican debates. But if you remember, they were almost all multi-candidate debates.
They sure were. Multi-candidate.
Yeah, it was 16, 17 candidates at the start. When it came down to just him and Ted Cruz and John Kasich, he decided he didn't want to debate anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the odds were no longer in his favor, if you will. So there's no guarantee that he'll agree to have a debate.
And what about this new entry yesterday, Evan McMullen? He's a former policy director of the House Republican Conference, CIA veteran. Is he considered a third-party candidate?
Well, you know, I would just view him as an independent candidate because he's not attached to a political party. You know, this is sort of a rump of disgruntled Republicans, and I guess he figures he has two possibilities here. You know, one is, it's interesting that he comes out of the CIA, comes out of the national security establishment, and there are a lot of prominent Republican voices who have just come out vocally against Trump from that corner of the government, saying, you know, that Trump would be actually a threat to national security. So it sort of makes sense that one of their own, you know, might put himself forward. I think the real factor there, given his background and the timing of when you can get on the ballots, people, because he's a Mormon, he may have some ability to draw votes away from Trump in states like Utah and Nevada, where there is a large Mormon population that's already leaning away from Trump. And, you know, frankly, he doesn't sound like a guy who wants to, you know, be the next president. He sounds like someone who wants to do whatever he can to stop Trump from being the president. And that is a perfectly valid role for an independent candidate. You know, they do have to say, I want to be president. But frankly, he has no hope of being president. But he has a chance of drawing enough votes away from Trump in a few states, you know, to put them into play for Clinton, and that could make a difference.
Mm-hmm. You've written that major parties have always responded to third-party challenges by co-opting their top issues. That's how smaller parties have managed to change the direction of the country. Has that happened in 2016? It certainly happened with Bernie Sanders.
Well, I think Sanders is in fact, you know, an example of a third-party politician, if you will, who decided to run inside one of the major parties. I mean, you know, Bernie, until this cycle, was never a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
In Vermont, he has, you know, called himself a Democratic socialist and always run as an independent. You know, there is a progressive party, capital P, in Vermont that has people who often vote for him, but he is not affiliated with them. He's not a member of the progressive party. And in the Senate and in the House where he was before, he always caucuses with the Democrats. But I think of Bernie Sanders as what Ralph Nader could have done in 2000 if he had run as a Democrat. You know, with his type of background and you know, same kind of appeal to young people, you know, he could have probably done extremely well in the primaries. You know, Sanders showed just how far you can go inside of one of the major parties as this kind of outsider. And it's an interesting strategy because it has moved. Everybody concedes that Hillary Clinton has moved to the left on a number of issues, ranging from the Trans-Pacific Treaty to the, you know, her policy on aid to students with college debt because of the pressure that was coming from the left from Sanders. So it's an excellent case for the same type of strategy, only inside one of the major parties.
Hmm. But then she runs the problem because she's also courting disaffected Republicans. So how much of Bernie's agenda do you take into a campaign, a national campaign that's trying to get people who don't like Trump, who normally would vote Republican? That's difficult.
Well, arguably, it's a lot easier when the candidate is Trump. And I think that's why Clinton is doing it. I think that, you know, Trump is such a radical break from the norms of presidential politics, and leaving aside the fact that he's so, you know, undoctrinaire, he definitely doesn't match up to traditional Republican positions. But his instability, his questions about whether he has the right temperament to be president, I think open up opportunities that, you know, if you're the Democratic candidate, you'd be stupid not to try and pounce on. You know, the problem for Hillary Clinton, who is obviously right now leading in the polls, is if she wins, what kind of government, what kind of presidency can she have? Is it just going to be 4 years of, you know, constant fighting with the Republicans who want to obstruct her at every turn? Or can she win over enough of, you know, votes from Republicans that Republican leaders in Congress think, you know, we got to deal with her? And at the same time, can she hold on to the votes that people on the left are currently giving her because they're so terrified of Trump? And I think that she's, you know, they're finally calibrating that strategy. And the more that Trump has the type of bad week like the one he just had last week, you know, the more she'll probably try and peel off mm-hmm. moderate Republicans and independents.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Mika Sifri is our first guest this hour, co-founder, executive director of Civic Hall. And he is talking about third party, what the threshold is needed in order to be invited to a presidential debate, if those even happen this year, because Trump has not said that he would be a part of those debates, why it is that we went from the Presidential Commission on debates rather than the League of Women Voters, when it may be a good idea to have third-party participation in debates, and we'll look a little bit more carefully at the third-party candidates the second half hour. Let's welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Are you entertaining the notion of voting for a third-party candidate this go-around? If so, why? What about third-party participation in debates if they happen? Should they happen? Is a 15% threshold, five major national polls giving a candidate 15%, and then he or she can be invited to the presidential debate, is that too high? Should it be lower than that? How would you determine which third-party candidates should be included in a presidential debate? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we start with Claire in Madison. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Claire.
I'm so glad you're discussing this today, because during this whole primary season, this has really, really been bothering me, this issue. We have a so-called democracy, but then we have these so-called private parties running the show and calling all the shots, and that just makes no sense to me. It should be far more open to everybody who wants to participate, who wants to try and get elected, and who made the Dems and Republicans in charge of everything. It seems crazy to me.
And do you think, where would you have a cutoff, Claire, if you were going to invite people to the debates?
I guess anybody that's eligible to get on a ballot, and I'm not sure what that entails, to be honest. I think they should be able to be involved in the debate, so mm-hmm. the people of the United States can make their choices intelligently.
Okay, thanks very much, Claire. What does it take to be getting on the ballot?
So, you know, this Claire's made a really great point, which is that the two parties, the two major parties, have artificially inserted themselves in the middle here. And by passing laws at the state level, they set up the requirements for how you get on the ballot, and it varies from state to state. There are some states where it's actually very easy. You just send a letter to the Secretary of State. Maybe you pay a small filing fee. There are other states where you have to collect hundreds of thousands of signatures, and you have to do so within a narrow time frame, and which basically means that you need to pay signature gatherers, you know, millions of dollars to help you get on the ballot, while the major parties automatically put their candidates on the ballot. And, you know, we used to have a more fluid system in America. People may not know this, but until the late 1800s, most states in America had multiple parties. More than two parties were involved in running and electing candidates to office. Frequently, this was because smaller parties fused with larger parties. They co-nominated the same person, but their ballots, the votes for that candidate, were counted on separate lines. So you could see if a smaller party made a difference. And that was a system that grew out of the fact that parties used to have to print their own ballots. And there was no centralized state-printed ballot. And when we moved to a system of having secret balloting, it had to be a ballot that was printed up uniformly by the state, and thus states got in the business of deciding what the threshold was for getting on the ballot. And quite naturally, the parties that were dominant chose to write those laws in ways to make them more dominant and to make it harder for new parties to come in. This is it is one of the crazy things about our system is we are living inside a very artificially constrained. I mean, I know the word rigged has other meanings,
right,
you know, that suggest corruption, but it is an artifice that dates back to the late 1800s. And as a result, it's very frustrating for people like your caller, Claire, who, you know, this grates against our common sense notion of how democracy should work.
Mm-hmm. So would you agree with Claire that if you can get on the ballot in, let's say, all 50 states or close to 50 states, you should be invited to the debates?
Well, what I think and what other people have suggested is the commission, which we're stuck with for the time being, should use a different threshold, which is they should look for polls that ask, which candidates would you like to hear from in the debates? And any candidate that has more than 50% support saying we would like to hear from that candidate would be invited. Because getting on the ballot, to be honest, any system you set up which makes it easy for lots of people to get into these debates, you may end up with a mess.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily want a debate with, you know, 10 different people on it just because they all managed to get on the ballot. You do want some threshold of seriousness that says, you know, a sufficient number of the public are interested in hearing more from this candidate. And that's why the idea of some threshold of interest, which can be polled, and that's different than saying I already support them, because then you put the candidate in a catch-22. They can't get sufficient support without being in the debate, but they can't get in the debate without the support.
Right. Right. Let's take one more call for you, Nancy in Minocqua. Hi.
Yes. When I first started, I wanted to just say I think everybody that wants to run should be able to be debating. And after listening to the last little bit, I don't understand why all this has to be for just rich people. I mean, if it's millions and millions of dollars that you have to pay to be on the ballot and then to try to become president, there's a lot of people in this country that don't have that kind of money, but yet may be very good presidents. I mean, I know that some of our founding fathers were probably not just the richest people in the world, and yet they created a country.
Mika.
Amen to that. I mean, you know, the one silver lining of this cycle, and maybe it's a harbinger of better things to come, that both Bernie Sanders and to some degree Donald Trump have shown, is that there are millions of people now who can make donations to a candidate in sufficient quantity that candidate doesn't have to be beholden to the rich. You know, Trump is now doing traditional fundraisers, so I'm really not going to give him the benefit of that statement too far. But Sanders, in particular, raised a record amount of money, in fact, more money than Hillary Clinton, from a much wider donor base, you know, with an average donation of something like $27, as he likes to say in his speeches. And so that opens up the possibility of somebody running for president who isn't rich. But they still have to, you know, they still have to be well known in some way. And that's, you know, and by the way, there does need to be some bar of qualification. I think we would all agree, whether it's experience or, you know, previous experience,
sure,
running something in government or running a big business or something that shows, you know, you're up. It's a pretty complicated job to be president. And, you know, we wouldn't necessarily want somebody whose main experience is, you know, being a reality TV show star or something, would we? He said, tongue in cheek. So, you know, I'm all for the capacity for through the Internet for more candidates to run without being beholden to big money. I think what we need to do is change our laws so that it's possible to qualify for public money to supplement what you can raise if you're willing to say, I'm not going to take any big donations. Then we'll get a lot of people running who are ordinary people who aren't relying on rich people in order to run for office. And I think that would get us much closer to what, you know, our founders' original vision was a government of independent minds, or people who are not dependent on others, including dependent on wealthy donors.
Yeah. We'll take one more call for you. We'll do it in just a moment. We have to pause for a moment, and we're talking about third-party candidates in this race, what it takes to get on the presidential stage, if there are going to be presidential debates. We still don't know at this point. Donald Trump has not committed to those. But it looks as Jill Stein is on the Green Party, and Gary Johnson, as I mentioned earlier, got 10% in the primary here. There is a chance that he could get to 15% in five national polls before the debate so that he could be on the stage. Who should be on the stage, and who is in charge of that, and the role of third parties in presidential history is what we're talking about. Mika Sifri joining us for one more phone call. We'll take it in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One more call for you, Mika, and it's Francis. Hi, Francis.
Hi. Great show, Kathleen.
Thanks.
I thought I heard this the other day on wherever I heard it, CNN, whatever, that the Republicans, after the 60 debate, did not participate in the 64, 68, and 72 presidential debates. I'm just wondering if that was true or not.
Yes, that's correct. There were no presidential debates until 1976, after what happened in 1960. So, yeah, again, that's another hint. These things are not locked in stone. So, you know, we shouldn't take them for granted.
So they decided, why? Why? Because Richard Nixon lost that race? They didn't participate in all those other debates?
To be honest, I don't know the answer to that question. And, you know, my guess would be that it was quite difficult to get both parties, you know, to agree to the setting and to the rules and to who the sponsor would be. You know, behind the scenes, this is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to give some credit to today's commission that they have succeeded in, at least from 1984 forward, making this a regular ritual that we have all come to expect will happen. And that certainly puts pressure on the candidates to participate. And in fact, as we're talking, I see that Donald Trump has told Time magazine that he is planning to debate, but he wants to negotiate. You know, we're negotiating now. Over the circumstances, given that everything Trump says comes with a backflip a provision available to him, I'll believe it when I see it, when it's all locked down.
Yeah. Thank you, Mika, so much for being with us. Most informative.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Yeah, Mika Sifri, and maybe you can join us again as we get closer to the debates, if the debates happen. Executive Director of Civic Hall, and he is the author of Spoiling for a Fight, Third Party Politics in America. Joining us now as we continue the same discussion of third party entries into the 2016 presidential race is Teresa Amato. She was the National Presidential Campaign Manager for Ralph Nader in 2000 and 2004, and is the author of Grand Illusion, The Myth of Voter Choice in a Two-Party Tyranny. Stay on the line if that's where you are. We'll be with you in just one moment. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Teresa, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Teresa. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. You're where are you, in London?
Rome.
Oh, you're in Rome. Oh, that's a nice place to be. Okay, well, let's carry right on. You have said that it shouldn't be said, although it has been said, that a third-party candidate can snatch victory from a major contender. Why shouldn't we say that?
Because every candidate has to earn their votes. The votes are not pre-assigned or predictable for one party or another. And so a lot of people like to look at it as a two-party horse race, where, as I believe, that every candidate has to earn their votes. And if we just say this country is going to be a two-party country only, it deprives people, voters, of the choice on the ballot. And we can't have a system that says we can only be a two-party country, because it's against everything we believe in terms of political competition.
So what procedures should we have in place in terms of having a name on a ballot that is not Democratic or Republican, and in terms of having those voices on the stage for a presidential debate?
Well, there are at least two things to look at, but there are a number of other electoral reforms that could be put into place. One is, and your prior guest, Mika Seyfried, touched on it, is how we create ballot access at the state level, because I don't think a lot of people realize that the state legislatures, which are predominantly controlled by one or the other of the two parties, have the ability, and definitely by both parties together, have the ability to set the rules for all other contenders. And as a consequence, some of the ballot access laws are extremely difficult to achieve. And people who want to put themselves out as a candidate with a set of ideas for voters to choose have difficulty just to get on the ballot. And this is not a small thing. This is 50 states running 50 different systems, plus the District of Columbia. And each one of those systems has a variety of different rules. I mean, the obstacles are staggering. Where you have to put the paperclip or the staple, who can sign, who can distribute or pass the petitions to collect signatures for people to be able to get on the ballot. What exactly has to be done in terms of when they can be turned in? How can you label yourself as a candidate? Who can become your vice presidential candidate? There are a variety of rules, many of them Byzantine, that prevent people from being able to surmount the ballot access hurdles. As a consequence, as you can see, it's very difficult for third parties to gain ballot access. Very few manage to get on the ballot of all 50 states, and usually litigation is involved oftentimes. And there's no reason that we do this to make it so hard. We could have a uniform ballot access law for federal candidates, and this could enable people to not have to spend two-thirds of their campaigns just trying to get on the ballot, which takes a lot of resources, a lot of people, and it's really an unbecoming obstacle for voter choice. Because candidate access is really the flip side of the voter choice. And so that's one aspect. In terms of access to the debates, I don't necessarily agree with Mika on what he said about 50% should be the yardstick. That could be one yardstick in terms of people wanting, more than 50% of the people wanting to see particular party or candidate in the debate. Another could be, are you mathematically viable in terms of the number of ballots that you're on? Are you mathematically viable in order to be able to get enough votes through the Electoral College to actually become the president? Or there could be a staggered system, whereas, you know, we only require candidates to obtain 5% of the vote in order to get general election financing. Why do we have to have 15% of a popularity poll when those polls are determined by the very bipartisan commission on presidential debates. And when it could be 5%, or it could be 5% to get into the first debate, and then 10% to get into the second debate, mm-hmm. and then 15% to get into the third debate. There are a variety of ways you can do this that are not a system that has routinely excluded third parties since 1992.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you would just have a big uproar from Democrats and from Republicans if you changed this and allowed more third-party candidates? They'd say, hey, you're going to make my chances even less here. I'm not participating if you're allowing these people in.
Well, you know, that's nice, but do we want to give that kind of control? Do voters in a country where more than 60% want a third party, mm-hmm. or more than 40% routinely identify themselves as independent, want to allow the two parties to dictate the terms of their presidential election? You know, we've tolerated this for quite a while. I'm hoping that this election in 2016 will cause many people to say, wait, why do we have this kind of system, and why isn't it viable for a third party to participate in the presidential election?
Let's go to
and other elections.
Yeah,
we have a ballot.
We have a lot of calls coming in, and we're welcoming them for Teresa at 800-486-8655. Teresa Amato, National Presidential Campaign Manager for Ralph Nader in 2000 and 2004, author of Grand Illusion, The Myth of Voter Choice in a Two-Party Tyranny. And our number is 800-486-8655. Fernando in Shorewood is next. Hi, Fernando.
Good afternoon. Thanks for letting me speak. I love your show.
Thanks.
I'm one of those people who voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. I spent, I'd say, 15 of the last 16 years thinking that I was a Green. I got to admit that Bernie Sanders had me thinking for about a whole year that I was a Democrat. And just to see what happened, you know, the way he was treated, to see that a major party basically admitted that they rigged a system to nominate someone, and then not see anybody face any kind of accountability for that, and not see any kind of anything in the system that would account for that or counterbalance that kind of corruption. It's kind of like the best proof on earth that I can't be a member of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has no room for people like me, liberals or progressives, who want to work within the system. I remember in 2000, I had friends who would mock us and say, hey, Ralph Nader would just run as a Democrat, you know, it would be fine. He wouldn't be spoiling anything. But here we are 16 years later. We have Bernie Sanders, a socialist, basically quitting, becoming a Democrat, playing by the rules, getting completely, just treated like an animal, basically. And then basically being told after that if I don't vote for Hillary Clinton, that there's something wrong with me, or that I'm privileged, or some, you know, whatever the narrative is.
So what are you going to do?
I'm going to vote for Jill Stein. I didn't vote for her 4 years ago because I didn't really care for her much as an individual, but I'm seeing now that I really don't have, it's strange, but ironically, Hillary Clinton is probably the best recruiter for the Greens that there is, because I've tried to become a Democrat again, and basically I can't unless I'm willing to turn in my vote in exchange for pretty much all of my principles.
Yeah.
I'm going to be voting as a Green, I guess.
All right, Fernando, thanks for the call. And you have said that we're paying too little attention to Jill Stein. Don't be surprised to see an exodus of wannabe Sanders revolutionaries for Stein, Teresa.
That's correct, because the problem is when you run within the Democratic Party and then as the nominee you throw your support to the person against whom you've spent all your time running, it doesn't do anything to change the politics of the country or to make the choices available for the electorate, like the gentleman who just called. And indeed, if you want to change the system, you have to vote outside the two-party system, or else get people in between the elections to change the rules by how the electoral process works. And there are a lot of organizations that are starved for attention, funding, help, that regularly take on these causes in between elections, but need people to support that effort and to to really decide as a country we're going to have this national discussion about how we conduct our presidential campaigns. I think there are a lot of people like the caller who are going to look now and say, what are my choices here and why don't I have more choices?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they will be voting for Jill Stein.
What do we do when, and who knows where the polls are going to be, it's now showing that Hillary Clinton has a fairly substantial lead. If the polls get closer, it's two questions. One, if the polls stay about the same, are people more likely to vote for a third party that more closely reflects what their beliefs are? If it gets closer, are they less likely to vote for a third party?
Kathleen, I'm so glad you asked me this question, because what happens is that invariably the presidential race is covered by the media as a national race. But the fact is, the way the Electoral College works is the votes matter on a state basis. And so people hear the media talking about, it's getting close, and then they become terribly afraid that they can't vote for their conscience, vote for the candidate that they prefer for a federal office in their state, when more likely than not, their state is a landslide for one of the two major parties. And so in some ways, I think the media fosters this idea that and the overwhelming fear that the more evil or the lesser evil cannot be voted for because it's going to be so close. Rather, people can't choose the candidate of their choice because they fear the other party more disparate from their own belief system. So more people have to focus on how the Electoral College works and know how that works and not be scared into voting for who they want for president of the United States.
We're talking about third-party candidates in the 2016 presidential race. Teresa Amato is our guest for the remainder of this hour, national presidential campaign manager for Ralph Nader in 2000 and 2004. Our number, thank you, Fernando, for your call, 800-486-8655. Also leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We like to read those, and we'll read one that's come in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go next to Rod in Weyerhauser. Hi, Rod.
Hello. A very interesting program again, Kathleen. Thank you.
Thanks, Rod.
I guess I am an ignorant, and because you'd have to be in politics all your life, not be ignorant, I guess. But anyhow, what I did hear on public radio, one of the programs about George Washington, they wanted him to belong to a party, and he says, no way. How? At the beginning of your program, when they said, well, so-and-so and this person are going to be invited to campaign. So I know, realistically, money is the fuel of the machine. But like John McCain and the Feingold McCain bill, wasn't that supposed to curtail the spending amount on campaigning? Because I'm going to borrow ex-president G.W. Bush is saying, who is the decider in the sky who's going to be allowed to run?
All right. Thanks, Rod, very much for your call. Who's to decide who's going to be allowed to run? Teresa?
Well, the people decide who should be allowed to run, in the sense that they determine who's elected, who makes the ballot access rules, who gets on the ballot. I think one of the questions we should ask ourselves as a country is, don't we want to have a more nonpartisan electoral system? Right now, there are thousands of jurisdictions that have control over the votes in their state. Oftentimes, the head of the state the state electoral machinery is either the attorney general or the secretary of state, who is a member of one of the major parties. Sometimes this individual will also wear the hat of being the chairperson for a particular candidate. And so we have a situation where people who back one candidate or another are also running the election machinery. I think that we have not even mastered the basics in the United States in terms of registering people to vote, making it easier for people to re-register after they move or to know that they're no longer registered to vote, eliminating the long lines at various polling stations because of a misallocation of either budget priorities or electoral machinery that frustrates, especially in low-income areas and student areas. And, you know, somebody looks at a line who's been working all day and it's running out the door and taking hours to be able to vote. This is not a system that welcomes public participation or that's designed to give everybody access, voice at the polls. And so we should make it easier to register to vote. We should make it easier for people to actually vote. We should make it easier for people to count the votes accurately and know what counts as a vote. And yet, even after we passed, after the Florida fiasco passed the Help America Vote Act, we still have these problems 4 elections later. And that's just unacceptable. So we should have nonpartisan administration of the vote process, and we should have a much better run electoral system in terms of just the execution.
We have this message.
Not to mention the big changes. Those are the small changes
right.
We could conquer as a country quite easily, not to mention the bigger structural changes like public financing, like getting rid of the winner-take-all system and thinking about how to have either instant runoff voting, proportional representation, some sorts of mechanisms. And we have a system that was, you know, first class in the 18th century, but we need to really think about how we're going to maximize voter participation and voter choice in the 21st century.
That's a long list, Teresa. Joe passes along this thought on Facebook. A wasted vote is an extra vote for the winner that wasn't necessarily for the winner to win. Let's go to another phone call. Gail is next in Belleville. Hi, Gail.
Hi there. I want to go back to the debates, and I was thinking if Trump decides not to participate in one or more of the debates, that would seem to throw out the agreement, the negotiations that the Democrats and Republicans had. And I think that the Democratic Party should then decide to have the debates with the third-party candidates.
All right.
And include them and have them and just ignore Trump.
We have about a minute left. Teresa?
I think the Commission on Presidential Debates should invite the candidates who are mathematically viable to become president of the United States to the debates. And I don't think we have to depend on one or the other of the major parties to not show up. I think it should just be standing invitation for those who can become president to be able to participate at least in one of the debates, and then we could, or structure a system, as I said before, to, in terms of who will people want to see in the debates. But as that's a bit of a circular standard because people don't even know necessarily about the other parties running.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Teresa, for being with us. Have a really good time in Rome if you're there for fun, or I hope you have fun even if you're not there for fun. Thank you for being with us. Thanks.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks. Teresa Amato, our guest, and she has an interesting political background, national presidential campaign manager for Ralph Nader in 2000 and also 2004, and author of Grand Illusion, The Myth of Voter Choice in a Two-Party Tyranny. And we, of course, are on top of this presidential stuff, so we will be doing a show, I'm sure, before the first presidential debate, or we'll find out what the negotiations are that Donald Trump is involved in concerning the debates before the first debate, which I think is September 26th. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this interesting hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. Hour 2, we'll be talking about Donald Trump. David K. Johnston, no stranger to this program, will be with us to talk about his latest book. He's been following Trump for 30 years, The Making of Donald Trump.